Louis Armstrong opening up today's Fresh Air with Harold Arlen's I've Got the World on a String. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4:30, we'll hear from Helen Sussman, a white South African parliament member who opposes apartheid. At 4 o'clock, Letty Cotton Pogrebin will share the findings reported in her new book, Among Friends. It's a study of modern friendship. She's found that many people have less and less time to make or even keep friends. Isolation, she says, is the price of our hectic lives and overcommitted schedules. Pogrebin is a founding member of Ms. Magazine. With me now on Fresh Air is jazz pianist and composer Sumi Tinoka. She was one of the most highly regarded young musicians on the Philadelphia scene, but a couple of years ago she decided it was time to move to New York. She still returns regularly to Philadelphia, not only to see family, but to play at the Frog's Piano Bar. She's there Monday and Tuesday evenings from 5:30 until 10:30. Sumi Tinoka's first album has just been released. It's titled With an Open Heart. It features Rufus Reed on bass and Akira Tana on drums. Before we meet her, let's listen to a selection from this new album. This is one of Sumi Tinoka's compositions. It's called Spur of the Moment. Pianist and composer Sumi Tanoka, we heard her piece Spur of the Moment from her new album With an Open Heart on Radiant Records. Sumi, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
This album has been in the works for a while. What has it been like for you to try to do it yourself? Because it is in many ways an independent production.
Oh, most definitely. Well, it's been an education, and it's been something that's been really beneficial to me. I mean, it's been wonderful, actually, because I've been learning so many things. I was quite reluctant to do it, to go all the way through with that, is to do the pressing and distribution and be responsible for all that at first. But now that I'm going through it, I really feel kind of fortunate.
You recorded this album about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still sound the same?
I don't think I do. I think most people, most musicians, changed from year, even from year to year, sometimes from month to month, and I think that my playing has definitely changed. It's hard to say exactly how. I'm coming out a little bit more, playing a lot more than I used to.
Some people tell me that after a book or a record or something big that you've been working on and waiting for a long time, that there's sometimes a period of depression that follows. Did you experience
postpartum
anything like that?
Postpartum blues.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like, it is kind of like having a baby, because it's like, it's been coming on for such a long time, and all of a sudden it's out there, and you just have to kind of deal with that. And I wouldn't say that I've been feeling depression. I've just been feeling the need to have to all of a sudden deal with all this business that that's sort of resting on my shoulders, that this record get out there, and I'm willing to work a lot harder for it because my blood is in this. You know, it is really something that I produced with the help of my backer, Guy Zantzinger, and a good friend, Matt Yapel. And we put it together, and it's just been a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of responsibility, and I've been so busy, I haven't had to think about all those things as far as worrying.
It's an important calling card. People can know who you are and music if they want to book you at a club or whatever and they haven't heard you on a date yet.
Yeah, for me, that's exactly what it is. That is the function of it for me. And it's definitely won't hurt.
You were a real major figure in the Philadelphia scene for several years, and then you moved, a couple of years ago or so to New York?
I've been living in New York now for going on 4 years.
Is it that long?
Time flies.
Why did you leave Philadelphia? What made you think that you really had to make that move?
Well, that's a good question. I think Philadelphia is relatively small compared to a city like New York City. And I had gained a certain amount of notoriety here. People knew who I was, and I was working pretty steadily. And it's a great city. I love the city. And it's a great place to come from. But I felt the need to be kind of exposed to the kinds of things that New York can expose me to that Philly can't, because of its size and because it's not really the kind of cultural mecca or center that New York City is.
When you were in Philadelphia, did you get the feeling that you were being defined as a local musician?
Well, you are, because you're here, you live here, and you work here, and you play here, and that is what you are. And I'm proud to be from Philly, and I'm glad, but you do. It's sort of somewhat of a syndrome you can fall into. I wanted to be challenged more and put myself in a situation where I would be challenged more in a certain way.
What is the implication, though, of a local musician?
Gee, I don't know exactly how to answer. I think that sometimes it's hard to get respect from major clubs, or because you are local, they don't want to pay you as good, or all that kinds of things. It's hard to negotiate as professional unless you're already on the public scene and already a well-known recording artist.
Did you want to start playing with different people also?
Well, sure. I wanted to meet more musicians. I wanted to play with more musicians. I wanted to be able to listen to more music, have the access to go out and hear it whenever I wanted to. And, New York is a real center, although it is expensive. It's extremely expensive. I don't hear as much music as I wish, because a lot of time it can be a big expense going out to hear music. But there's also some really great clubs there where you can just go and check out someone. You only pay for a bar tab or something, and it can be really great.
Did you make any preparations before going?
Well, not really. I didn't really have any steady work there when I went, and that kept me from going for a long time, because I didn't have any steady work there, and I still don't have steady work there. But I figured I better do it before I don't want to do it again. It's something that took a lot of courage, and I was kind of afraid to go for a really long time. But one of the things that you learn is that there are so many wonderful musicians there, but there's so many musicians there, and you know, it's in such a wide range. And I used to feel, oh, well, I have to be as great as such and such a player. But it's really not that way. There's a lot of room for a lot of different types of players, and I found it to be really good for me.
New York is one of the pushiest places. Do you feel like you're able to be assertive about making yourself known and meeting the right people?
Well, you have to be. I mean, it puts you in a situation where if you're not assertive, then you're not gonna do it. You have to be, and that's been good for me too, to get to the point where I know that I have to push myself. And it's not something that comes naturally for me. It's something that I have to kind of work on. But there are a lot of beautiful musicians there, and they're like people, you know. I mean, they are people, and they're approachable. So I've had some support.
What keeps you coming back to Philadelphia to play at the Frog?
Well, the Frog, I've been working there now, I can't believe this, but it's been like 6 years, and it's been very steady for me. And I work there on the off nights, and to me, it's like kind of getting paid to practice, and it's been really wonderful in that it's been so steady. They give me a lot of flexibility. I have some really nice people who come in there. I play there on the off night, so a lot of time it's nice and quiet and I can hear myself. And I like the room, and I haven't been able to find a room quite like that in New York yet. And it's tough getting a room like that on a steady basis, so I still come back to do it. It's not that long of a commute.
There are times, I think, at every piano bar where people aren't paying close attention to the music. Are you able to concentrate on what you're doing even at those times when the listeners aren't?
Well, sometimes it's hard. I mean, that gig is a 5-hour gig, and depending on how much energy I have and how I'm feeling that day, sometimes it can be harder than other times. But I think that overall, because I've had to do that job and play by myself in a situation that way, that it's kind of developed my concentration so that if I feel like playing, I'm going to play regardless of what's happening around me.
Can you test out compositions there and see if it gets any reaction from the listeners?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I have some customers who come in and request a lot of my own tunes, which has been really nice. And one night I was playing one of my own compositions, and there was a couple sitting in the corner, and they started crying, and they came up to me, and they told me how they were moved, and I was just totally blown away that I could affect people like that. That was really special, though. That doesn't happen all the time.
Do you ever worry about whether you'll be able to support yourself all your life through music? It's so hard to do, and a lot of musicians, like a lot of writers, aren't able to do that.
Sure, worry about it all the time. It's a tough lifestyle, being a jazz musician. I look at some of the people that I know are well-respected and who are, in my mind, really big and have made it to a certain extent. And still, even those people, they have to work in, like, some local places in New York City or local clubs. And it takes a lot of energy. It's very demanding. And I do worry about it, whether I want to keep being a performer, or whether maybe look at some other options as far as getting into an academic situation. A lot of people do that. They teach, and like Max Roach, I think, has a position at a university. And it's a good way to have some kind of security and be creative at the same time. So I do see that as a possibility, but right now I want to try to do as much performing as I can.
Do you have any friends who eventually gave up music because it wasn't paying off for them?
Sure. Some incredibly talented people. I mean, musicians who I just think were absolutely phenomenal. And some of them, I don't think they've given up music totally, but they want to have another way of making money, and they want to save their music to be able to just play. And I can understand that. Because once you start making money and supporting yourself at it that way, certain things change. Sometimes it's hard to keep your inspiration up, or the same kinds of feelings that you've had about the music, because you do have to support yourself, and it can be very taxing on you.
What do you think about when you see that happen? People who you think are really talented but have given it up?
I feel sad. I always try to make people, you know, get back to their music, even if they're not doing it regularly, because it's important. I feel that being a musician, you know, it helps other people too, because people listen and they get something from it, and it's like a beautiful situation. And now these times, I feel like these times, there needs to be, the more music played, the better, because I think we're living in some pretty dark times right now.
Let's play some music now. I want to play another selection from your album. My guest is Sumi Tinoka, who grew up in Philadelphia and left here a few years ago and now lives in New York. She has a brand new album. It's called With an Open Heart. It's on Radiant Records with Rufus Reed on bass and Akira Tana on drums. I want to play one of your compositions called Phantom Carousel, and this is a solo piano piece. Is there anything you can tell us about the writing of this?
Well, this piece is based on a six-tone symmetrical scale, and I've dedicated this piece to Dennis Sandoli, who is someone I've worked with here in Philly. I've studied with him, and he gave this scale to me and told me to come up with a composition, and that's what I did.
Let's hear it. This is Phantom Carousel. Pianist Sumi Tinoka playing her composition Phantom Carousel from her new album With an Open Heart. It's a really beautiful piece, Sumi.
Thank you, Terry.
You know, let's talk about your background a little bit. I should mention that you're half black, half Asian. Your mother was Japanese, father a black American, and you're also a woman, which our listeners know. And because of that, you've had all these opportunities to probably feel totally marginalized in America. Have you had to choose which background you're going to identify with most, Asian or black?
No. I mean, I don't feel like I have to choose. That is something, my identity is something that I feel very proud of, and I feel that I am equally influenced by the fact that my father is black and that my mother is Japanese, and I feel very proud of both heritages. You know, they're both part of who I am. I've chose to use my mother's maiden name for performing because it's a very unusual Japanese name, and she only has one brother, and he only has one son, and I felt that I would like to perpetuate that name, Tonooka, but I don't feel that that kind of counts out the fact that I'm also black. Some people have seemed to, you know, they see me and they want to categorize you right away. Oh, well, she's this or she's that. But I think the whole thing for me is to try to just feel within myself comfortable with who I am and what I am. And then later for those people who have problems with being able to, you know, categorize me.
Was that more of a problem when you were younger? Because kids, I think, can sometimes really form tight-knit cliques based on sometimes ethnic group.
Yeah, that's true. And it was a problem, but my parents really made a concerted effort to put us in interracial schools. And I grew up in Palatine Village, which is a very mixed sort of bohemian type neighborhood. And they really kind of helped. I think they had an awareness of that. And I feel that I was supported from them.
I think some black jazz musicians see jazz as the domain of black Americans, and that other people won't be able to play the music as well. Have you been exposed to that way of thinking at all, and do you fit in?
Fit in how?
For people who see it as a predominantly Afro-American musical form.
Well, it is. It is an Afro-American musical form, and that's where the roots are, and I think that no one can ignore that or deny that. But I don't think that that discounts other people who want to play the music, or that it means that other people can't contribute to the music. I mean, there are so many wonderful musicians from all over the world who have, you know, picked up jazz and are playing jazz, and they're, some of them are wonderful musicians.
As a woman, have there been assumptions that have been made about you, about what kind of music you can or can't play?
Well, I'm sure there have been, and not that they've all been discussed or brought up, you know, with me. But, yeah, that's something you have to deal with, being a woman player.
Have you tried to bend over backwards to prove that you can play with muscularity, and, you know, that you could... You can improvise and know that, you know, all the, you know, because a lot of men would probably assume, oh, a woman, she probably just plays ballads, probably can't play, you know, very percussively or anything like that. Do you run up against those stereotypes?
Sure, you run up against those stereotypes. And people will do that. You know, people tend to do that, especially other male musicians. They think, oh, well, she's only going to play with a light touch or all those kinds of things. But I wouldn't say that I've tried to bend over backwards. I think I've gotten a little bit beyond that right now. Because really, I mean, when it comes down to it, the most important thing to me is the music. And I feel that I'm an artist, and that's where my dedication goes. And so that's what I'm thinking about. And if other people have problems with that, I can't, you know, throw too much energy in that direction, because that's just going to take away from what I have to give to the music.
Is there an equivalent of an old boys network in the jazz world?
What do you mean? I don't understand.
Well, sir. In the business world, there's all kinds of cliches about how, you know, a lot of the business decisions get made either in the men's room or in the bars after hours, in places where women aren't really invited, so that women are sometimes excluded from certain decisions that are made, or even from certain gossip.
Yeah, probably somewhat. You know, it's a very male-dominated art form, and I'm sure that there are, you know, women players are probably affected by that to some extent. I don't know exactly, you know, how, but, well, I don't know. I don't know exactly about that.
Okay, so you haven't felt excluded from any scenes?
Well, you know, the whole scene as far as sitting in and that kind of thing, that can be a very aggressive type situation. And in New York City, it really is. And I think that a lot of women players might try to approach getting into the scene as far as playing, maybe not so aggressively as far as, like, taking their acts and going to sit in. And maybe that's not good. Maybe women should be doing more of that. But I think sometimes it's hard as a woman to be able to do that. It also depends on your personality and how you want to carry yourself and present yourself. I think there are certain problems that women have that they have to deal with that makes it different for them in terms of being a jazz player because of those kinds of attitudes.
What kinds of problems?
Well, like that kind of thing, maybe people assuming that you can't play, or if you are a musician that you're going to be a singer, not necessarily a musician. Or if you're going to play an instrument, it's probably piano or maybe flute, you know, not drums or saxophone. But right now, there are a lot of women musicians on the scene, and they're playing all kinds of instruments, and to me, it's great.
Is there a generational difference among the men or older men who didn't grow up with feminism more resistant to women players?
I wouldn't like to make that as a generalized statement, because I don't know. I think it really depends on the person and their attitudes about music in general. I think that if you can play and you're about the music, then, you know, you will get respect. I do feel that way. So it's a matter of just kind of sticking to your guns and just keeping at it.
I think a problem that all women face who are among the first in their field is that anything they do can be misinterpreted as a sexual cue, you know? do you have to try to prevent signals like that so that people don't misinterpret what your business is?
Oh, sure. And that happened to me, especially when I was younger and just coming out and playing. That was happening an awful lot. And I had to kind of develop a certain attitude where, you know, I had to make people take me seriously. But it was difficult at first because I was kind of green as far as handling myself in those kinds of situations. But now it's like I just won't deal with people that way, and I'll tell them off in a second.
You studied with Mary Lou Williams for a while, and she's a pianist who started playing in the 1930s with the big bands and then led many group of her own. And she's one of the first women composer, arranger, pianist to really become prominent in jazz. Did you talk with her about being a woman in the jazz world?
A little. Not a lot. She told me, you know, you have to go through the muck of the mud, you know. And I know that she had stopped playing at one point for quite a while and then came back. And she had it rough personally. And she shared some of that with me, but not a lot, because we were at the piano and we were talking about music. But for me, she was definitely a guiding light as far as being a woman and someone who I've been very much influenced by, not only by her music, but by her spirit, because she was just strong and a very beautiful spirit.
Well, one last thing on the subject, which is, will you confront a man who you think is reacting to you not as a fellow musician, but as a woman? You know, I mean, who has these stereotypes about what it means to be a woman, and they're not really dealing with you on your own terms.
Yes.
What will you say?
What will I say?
Yeah, what kind of things can you say?
Well, let me see. I'm trying to think of situations where it's happened, because I'll ask them what their problem is and try to confront them directly instead of, you know, I'll ask them, well, what is it? What is it with you? Like, what's the problem? And kind of take it from there. And sometimes it's not worth it, because some of these people, you know, it's hard. I don't know that anything I could say would change their mind. So it depends. It depends on what the situation is. But I'm trying to be much more aware of that kind of attitude and be able to confront it, because I think it's important for women to do that.
My guest is pianist and composer Sumi Tanoka, and we're going to hear another selection from your album. And this is the album With an Open Heart. It's just been released on Radiant Records. Why don't we listen to Bittersweet, which is from a suite that you wrote. Do you want to say something about it by way of introduction?
Well, it's the first movement of the suite, and it's in 6-8. And let's see, what else can I say about it? That's about it.
Okay, let's hear it. This is Sumi Tanoka's composition, Bittersweet. Thank you. That was Bittersweet, a composition by pianist Sumi Tanoka from her new album, With an Open Heart. And Sumi Tanoka is my guest in the studio. She's originally from Philadelphia, now lives in New York, and her new album is on Radiant Records. How did you gravitate toward piano? Did you have a choice of instruments?
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact, because my mother put me in a music workshop as a kid at Settlement Music School, and that's where they introduced you to a lot of different kinds of instruments. But my mom had a piano in the house, and I just sort of naturally gravitated to it as a kid. She didn't push me into it. She didn't force me, and I just kind of went right to it.
Did your parents listen to jazz?
My mother was a big fan, and both my parents were, you know, involved in the music. But my mom and my father took me to see Thelonious Monk when I was 13 years old at the Aqua Lounge, and that was my first exposure to live jazz. And I kind of decided at that time that, boy, if I'm going to be a musician, I want to be a jazz musician. I was playing then, you know, but that was the night that kind of turned me around.
Was it the music or the music and the mystique?
Both, definitely. There was so much excitement, and I remember just really responding to the music, though, too. It was just, to me, it was very exciting.
What were your early lessons like? I think early lessons can really help or hurt a young musician. You know, if you have the wrong teacher, it can really discourage you and give you the wrong idea about what music is.
That's true. Well, I was taken out, I think I was pulled out of my music workshop class because my teacher thought that I was gifted or something and wanted me to start taking an instrument right away, and I decided I wanted to take piano. And she put me with a teacher who was very traditional and very old school. And when I went to her, I was playing a lot by ear and not really reading music. As a matter of fact, I was playing some pretty difficult pieces by ear and not really reading, just sort of faking my way through. And this teacher was she was extremely upset that I was doing this and not, you know, using my ear and not reading the music. So she taught me how to read music, but in the process almost made me afraid of the instrument because I was just petrified because she was just so, you know, we're going to take you all the way back to the beginning. You have to know what you're doing. But now that I look back on it, I'm very grateful because she taught me how to read, and I wasn't doing that at the time.
Did jazz feel like your native tongue? Could you think easily in the language of jazz?
Gee, I never thought about that. Yeah, in some ways, it just seemed natural to me in a lot of ways. I mean, I was listening to it as a kid. I used to listen to Nina Simone. I had favorite Nina Simone record and Fats Waller. And it was something I was exposed to and kind of gravitated towards pretty naturally. So,
who were your most influential teachers?
Well, Mary Lou Williams, for sure. I also studied classical music with a teacher by the name of Susan Starr. She's a pianist, and she was also someone I saw as a little kid. My mom took me to see her at the Academy of Music, and she was the first female musician that I saw perform, and I was really stunned. I mean, I think I was about 10. I was like, look at that lady up there on the stage. And, you know, and I ended up studying with her in college, and I'm really grateful because she, as far as really getting into the piano and what the piano is all about and understanding, you know, technique and being able to get the music out of the piano and different sounds and textures, and she really got me thinking like that, and it's just been so incredibly valuable to me now.
One of the things I notice about your playing is you seem to have a very sensitive touch. You can go from a very percussive sound to a very kind of light, you know, kind of gentle sound, and you have a lot of, I think, control on your fingers, and every note rings true no matter how quickly you're playing a scale or a phrase or whatever. And I was wondering if that's the kind of technique that was the classical lessons helped you
with.
Sure,
definitely. Yeah, and it's something I'm still working on, Terry. You know, you can always get better. And
how do you work on that?
Well, I still practice a lot of classical music. I practice Chopin etudes and I practice Brahms technical exercises, try to do that every day when I can. If I don't do those, then I'm playing like my frogging and I'll be playing 5 hours or 4 hours a night at there. So, you know, you just have to stay at the piano. You have to stay at your instrument.
So you still practice?
Yeah. I hope I'll be practicing the rest of my life. Sure. I think it's important. You know, it's like an athlete. You have muscles in your hands or wherever. If you're a wind player, your breath is involved, or actually your breath is involved no matter what instrument you're playing, but you have to be able to develop and train, and it's like being an athlete. It's very similar.
Do you ever schedule in time away from your instrument?
No, I don't need to schedule time away because there are a lot of other distractions that take me away from. Yeah.
Your mother, who you mentioned was interested in jazz, I think that you'd once said she was a feminist, too. Did she encourage you to play in spite of, you know, some of the obstacles she probably figured you'd be meeting in the jazz world?
Oh, most definitely. My mother has got to be my biggest support out there, and really one of the main reasons I'm playing jazz or being a musician anyway. It's funny because when she was a kid, she had an incredible desire to play the piano, but her parents were very poor and they lived on a farm, and you know, she couldn't. So she made sure when she had her children that she was going to, that they were all going to have piano lessons, that they were all going to play instruments. And I know that she's very pleased that I've become a professional musician, and she's been incredibly supportive for me in every way.
That's really nice. I know a lot of parents would rather that their child become a chief executive officer or a doctor or a lawyer rather than a musician.
Well, my mother is an artist in great many ways. She's a creative person. She's a writer and teacher, and she understands what it means to be an artist. And her aesthetic is not money at all. It's the inspiration behind the art. And she took me to museums when I was little. She made a big effort to take us and expose us to culture, you know. So I have an artist viewpoint.
One of the things she was exposed to was the Japanese-American internment camp during World War II. Did she talk to you much about that?
Well, when I was little, not that much, because I think she was kind of not really in touch with as much of maybe trying to run away from dealing with that. But as she got older, she really started to confront the whole experience, and she started writing about it. And it was when she was writing about it that I started to learn all these things. And she's got a, you know, she's written a book, actually, that hasn't been published yet, but which I've read, and I'm so glad that she did that, because we have that now. And there's also been a film made on her where the filmmaker took her back to the campsite that she was at, and you know, where she was interned, Manzanar, and then took her home to Seattle and brought her back. And she hadn't been there since she had left for the camps. So they made a film on her. It was a half-hour documentary done by the Pearls series on Japanese-Americans, and it was called Emmy. And I did some music for that also.
Did you grow up with a certain amount of cynicism about America because of her internment experience?
Well, I wouldn't say I grew up with that, because she didn't really start getting in touch with that until I was older. But now I definitely have that awareness.
It's nice that you had a project to work on together.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're going to be doing another project together, because I got a grant to write a piece of music based on the internment of the Japanese during World War II. And my mom is, it's going to be a three-part piece, each piece being based on each generation's experience, how that experience was affected each generation. So I have a piece for the Issei, which is the generation from Japan, the Nisei, which is my mom's generation, and the Sansei, which would be the last movement, that is my generation, American second generation.
What's the difference between your generation and your mother's generation, do you think? Are there obvious differences?
Sure. I think that the Nisei is first born here. That's the first generation that was born here. And I think that a lot of them have certain kinds of identity type of problems because their parents were from Japan, and they were the first to a generation to adjust to being Japanese-American. And I think that a lot of people who are born after that and the generations after that have a little more confidence and a little bit more sureness of who they are and that kind of thing. And I do see that in the Sansas. They're not as, they don't seem to have as many identity crises type of things happen to them.
My guest is pianist and composer Sumi Tanoka. We've talked about your playing. We haven't talked much about your composing. Yeah. Do you compose at your instrument?
Yes.
Does the music come to you, though, when you're not even near your instrument?
Yes. Yeah, it really does. A lot of time it's very visual, and it always happens to me in spurts. I can spend a long time not composing, and then all of a sudden I'll have, like, all these compositions that just come out. And I try not to force it too much, although I don't feel good when I'm not writing, you know, so I try not to let too much time go by either. But you can't, it's not something that you can really say, well, I've got to do this and it's got to come out right this minute, because sometimes it just doesn't happen that way. Or if you do that, which I have done, sometimes it's not one of your better compositions. With me, it's always been something that kind of, I know what I want and I stay there until I say, this is what it is. And usually when I know that, it kind of starts happening, the form takes shape, you know.
Is there a period where you just have to leave yourself open and wait, you know, just leave yourself receptive for ideas to
definitely,
come?
Definitely, most definitely, yeah.
You have worked as a sideman and as a leader. Is it easy to take control as a leader when you're still, you know, fairly young and you don't, especially like before you had your album out and before you were you know, getting well known?
No, it's not easy. And it takes, you know, you have to have a certain amount of confidence and you have to know what it is that you want to do. As a leader, there are certain responsibilities put on you. You have to be able to explain what you want to happen in the music and what the music is about to the people that are working with you. And you have to, in some ways, sort of demand respect. And by doing that, you have to know what you're doing. You really have to know what you're doing as far as being a leader. You have to be able to explain all those things.
Do you like when you're leading a gig to have people play your pieces?
Well, yeah. When I'm concertizing, I like to play my originals, because I don't feel that there's enough. You know, there needs to be more new music written, and I've been writing as long as I've been playing. I started composing before I actually started taking lessons. I was making up stuff on the piano, and that's always been a big part of who I consider myself as a musician, the compositions also. And it's also a vehicle to really express yourself in a more personal way, like by creating the music that you perform. I feel it's important.
Okay, well, I really want to thank you for talking with us, and I wish
thank
you the
Terry.
Best, and thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been jazz composer and pianist Sumi Tanoka, who is originally from Philadelphia and now lives in New York. She still comes back to Philadelphia a couple of nights a week to perform at the Frog Piano Bar. She's there Tuesdays and Wednesdays from 5:30 to 10:30. She has a new album out, and it's called With an Open Heart, and I want to play another selection from it. This is another composition by Sumi Tanoka called How Can This Be? Thank you. Pianist Sumi Tanoka playing her composition How Can This Be, with Rufus Reed on bass and Akira Tana on drums, from Sumi's new album With an Open Heart. This is Fresh Air. It's 4 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up in about a half hour, 91FM News Director John Barth speaks with Helen Sussman, a white anti-apartheid activist in South Africa who's a member of the parliament there. First, Marty Moss Cohen speaks with Letty Cotton Pogrebin. Pogrebin has just written a new book called Among Friends. The book is based on social research analyzing friendship and on Pogrebin's interviews with about 150 people. She found in these interviews that many people have less and less time to make or even keep friends. The price, she says, for our hurried and hectic lives is isolation and loneliness, because it's friends that provide a sense of belonging and a feeling of community. From her research, she found that while we live in a decidedly heterosexual culture, most of our friendships are homosocial. By that she means that men tend to befriend men and women tend to befriend women. In her book, Pogrebin looks at why we make the friends we do, how men and women develop different kinds of friendships, and what values different cultures and ethnic groups attach to friendship. Letty Cotton Pogrebin is a founding member of Ms. Magazine. Her other books are Growing Up Free and Family Politics. She was the co-developer with Marlo Thomas of Free to Be You and Me. Among Friends is published by McGraw-Hill. Letty Pogrebin spoke with Marty Moss Cohen.
Why was it important for you to write a book about friends and friendship?
I guess because I felt as though I was a very inadequate friend. I was critical of the lack of time. I felt as though I wasn't balancing my life properly between family, work, and friendship. And then I had an experience around my own dinner table that galvanized me into action, and that was a dinner party where Alan Alda was one of my guests, and he was writing the script of a movie that became The Four Seasons. He asked everybody to let him pick their brains about friendship, and what I heard around my own dinner table were my own feelings reflected in the lives of others. And so it set me thinking about friendship as a much bigger subject than my own deep, dark secret. And I did 2 years of research and interviewed 150 people and ended up with 16 chapters on the subject.
We don't tend to analyze our friends. And
no,
I think that sometimes that's what makes them our friends as opposed to people that we live with.
Well, friendship is the only relationship of significance in our lives that has no rules. It's not institutionalized the way marriage is or parent-child relations or boss-worker relations. So we all feel our way, and sometimes we have a set of expectations that is not the same one that our friends have. As a result, we have problems we didn't expect. We certainly don't expect the negatives. And we're forced to think about a relationship that we didn't learn about in our psychology courses, and there are no such things as friend therapists the way there are marriage therapists. So we're left to our own devices, and I felt as though we needed a little more consciousness about this very vital experience and relationship in our lives. It was helpful in my case because I discovered there is no such thing as a perfect friend. Mm-hmm. And when you give up that image of perfection, you're free to appreciate the friends you have for what they are.
Do you think many of us are looking for a perfect friend the way we're looking for a perfect lover?
Absolutely. I think it's comparable also in the sense that you reach a certain maturity when you understand that you have to take people with their flaws and that, in fact, you're not going to get everything that you need from one place. That you perhaps are going to have to find in three or four or five different people what you were seeking in a single ideal relationship. And that there's a place for variegated, diverse interactions in our life. I discovered when I was thinking about my own friendships,